Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge with a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and I.
Everyone, this is Fran Lewis. I'm your host. This is MJ Network, MJ in memory of my sister Marcia Joyce, and this is going to be a fantastic show. Once in a while, you get lucky and you meet people or you talk to people that are so kind and understanding that you have to thank them for what they're about to do for you. The people at Jewish Monuments, Yosef and his expert staff, have been doing this for decades, and they have streamlined the process of ordering a Jewish monument. They're going to power wash and clean the stones that are in disarray at the cemetery where my family is. They're going to fix the foundation so they're not tilted over. They have superior workmanship, and what's even better, they have accurate Hebrew, which is really, really, really important. They're very patient and caring. I know that because I've spoken to them so many times. The headstones have a design idea, and whatever you like, they will do for you. They do granite, and they do bronze, and I've checked out their everything that they do. They're fantastic, and the stones are so beautiful. As a pros in the field of Jewish memorialism, JewishMonuments.com provides full monuments maintenance services, including headstone lift cleaning, repairs, and more. So call Yosef at 732-901-3030. Yeah, I have it memorized. 732-901-3030 and tell him Fran from Blog Talk Radio, MJ Network, sent you. And now this is going to be fantastic. This book, The Third Daughter by Tanya Connor, is fantastic. Tanya's research allows readers to experience within the timeline of this historical novel based on real-life events the truth about a very serious issue, sex trafficking, the inner workings, and the conditions of the brothels and those who justify their actions and greed. Power, control, fear, slavery, anti-Semitism, while just some of the issues brought to light in this powerful, charged novel, as Batya, the main character of the book, hopes to save her family and, of course, the third daughter. Good morning, and I'm so honored to have you here.
Thank you so much, Fran, for having me on your show. It's been delightful. I know you had loved my previous novels, and I am thrilled that you feel so strongly about this new one, The Third Daughter.
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, this is about the fifth or sixth book on this topic. But yours and one other by Mark Greene, 1 Minute Out, seem to be the two that really hit it on the head. And as I was reading it, I have to be honest, I felt like I was going through this with the girls that were there. So in the Jewish religion, we have, and my grandfather tried to do this to me, explain marriage. So why would these people arrange a marriage, and why do the parents of the young girl agree without knowing the man at all, that hard, that much? That bothered me, but that makes sense because that does happen.
At the time of the story, and I must say that it's true until today in some parts of Jewish streams, matchmaking is the way in which people get together, families make the arrangements, and the couples meet for the first time under the chuppah. In modern Orthodox today, they sometimes have coffee, the chaperoned environment once or twice. But at that time and place, we are talking the Eastern Europe, the Jewish population. That's how marriages were made. So it was totally acceptable and the way to do it.
Yeah, I know. My grandfather wanted to make a match between myself and the rabbi's son. And I knew the rabbi's son. He's a wonderful person, but I wasn't exactly the right match for them. So we both agreed. He was gorgeous. He was nice. We were friends. He tutored me. I spoke fluent Hebrew, but some of the translations were hard, so he was helping me with my translations in college, and we both agreed we would rather stay friends. So his parents did introduce him to somebody, and he came up and he goes, "Not going to happen, not this one." So I told him, we sort of figured out how to get him out of it, and he wound up marrying somebody that looked just like his mother. So he was happy. So how would you describe this family, and why would they send her away? And what did they hope to gain that they didn't realize that they weren't going to gain, which is really sad?
The family is inspired by Sholom Aleichem's short stories about Tevyeh and Golde and their daughters, which we are all very familiar with from the theatrical adaptation of Fiddler on the Roof. Originally, the stories were told to the author, supposedly in a fictional way, when the author would take train rides in Russia, and different characters came on and told the author their stories. And Tevyeh was one of them. He would get on the train, and he would say, "Oh, Mr. Author, here you are. Again, let me tell you what happened to my next daughter." In the first story, Tevyeh says he has seven daughters. Then in the second story, he says he has six. And at the end, he told the stories of only five. The theatrical adaptation of Fiddler on the Roof is one that had been done until that time, including one that was done by Sholom Aleichem himself back in the days. But definitely is the only one that stayed. So in that respect, the family is the one that Sholom Aleichem, first of all, it was intact, meaning a father, and regardless of their number, unusual under the circumstances of the pogroms that were absolutely ravaging the Jewish communities, breaking up, people were killed, talking about a very high mortality for maternity, women to as many children as, and they died. Every simple cop to something that people, it was less community to have act for. And therefore, being on environment where my story begins, continuing with proof after they leave the state and meet the sleazy of the men from Buenos Aires. Environment, as I'm mentioning at that time, in 1882, for example, in the Ukraine alone, there were 1,200 pogroms. And that in addition to the edicts of the Tsar that prohibited the Jews from holding certain professions or owning property. There was a very quota of education in the general institutions, and they were forbidden from living in cities. Their lives were miserable from whichever direction you were looking at, and if they wanted to leave, just the visa cost was exorbitant, and the men had to stay in the Russian Tsar army for 25 years. So with everything else was the pressure, and then they could not leave. And here, people had the dream of escaping this situation. But how were they going to do it? Armies of America was the one way of doing it. Even though in Sholom and his stories of Tevyeh, at the end he is moving to what he calls Palestine, which is what I used in my book, not the Fiddler on the Roof version of going to America. Nevertheless, for one member of the family to move to the new world and then make some money and then bring the family along – was the way to go, and they could not afford passages for all of them. And that's what the parents were hoping to accomplish. This was going to make her happy. They also believed that the daughter would be happy with a rich husband who would shower her with gifts, who would have her dress well and eat well. They were starving. They were starving. They had very little food. So just eating was such a big deal for them, being able to eat decent meals. And that's what they were trying to accomplish, happiness for her and happiness for the rest of the family.
That's so sad. My grandmother lived through the pogroms, and my grandmother was a victim of the sterilization camps too. So she,
my grandfather
had to get her from the underground, her and her five sisters. And it wasn't really my grandmother, it was my grandmother's sister that he married 3 months after my grandmother died. My real grandmother died. She was the best of my grandmother. So she went through everything.
But if she was sterilized, then you wouldn't be around now.
Yeah, they sterilized her so she couldn't have children. And I didn't know that.
Okay, but she couldn't be your grandmother. She didn't have children.
Yeah, well, she was my, not my real grandmother. She was my step-grandmother. She was my, my grandfather married my grandfather married my grandmother's sister after 3 months because he had five kids.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I didn't know
this until after she died, but she was the best, so it didn't matter. So, they believe this, so they explain, why did they use, she came here, this poor girl, never knew what hit her when she got here. Why was prostitution the way for them to make money at the expense of these young girls? I mean, I just finished 3 books like that, and even these girls felt the same way. Once they're trapped, they're afraid to leave because they're afraid they're going to hurt their families. They're afraid they're going to hurt them. Even if they had somebody coming to get them out, they wouldn't get out sometimes. So why prostitution, and why didn't anybody stand up for them? Nobody there.
You just asked me a few questions together, so I will try to combine them. Trafficking is very lucrative as long as the punishment is minor and the risks are very small. So there will always be those who prey on vulnerable people. And we are talking about an immigration community where they would believe the false promises of jobs and marriages and then could be forced into prostitution once they reach the destination. This was true 120 years ago where my novel is set, and it's unfortunately true today. The difference from our point of view is that we have changed our sensibilities. We now understand that these women and girls and women are victims, and we have established, and in the United States alone there are maybe 3,000 organizations meant that work very hard to help victims of trafficking in many ways on a high level of legislation and on right on the ground with hands-on helping them get out of the trap. But at the time of the novel, the Jewish community did not see the prostitutes as victims. They lumped them together with the pimps as putting terrible stain on the Jewish reputation. Jews had enough problems to deal with, to start with major anti-Semitism. Coming to the New World of South America, my story is based in Buenos Aires, where Batya, the protagonist, has been lured from her parents, whom we know, Tevye and Golde, and she's forced into prostitution, and she has a moral dilemma of whether to commit suicide when she realizes that the man is in Moskowitz is not going to marry her, but rather is forcing her into prostitution. So between accepting it and still have the chance of make some money and save her family from Russia. And that's the first moral dilemma she encounters in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And she finds ways to live with it. The Jewish community of the place and the time did not take well to any of that. They were starting a new life. The good Jews were starting a new life, and here the pimps were creating an environment in which they were fostering a new anti-Semitism in a new world. So, of course, that was unacceptable, and that made things very difficult.
The sad part is anti-Semitism today, too, and in the news. That's the sad part, too. It hasn't changed, and that's what gets me really. It gets you really angry and upset. People don't.
Today
they got a new false face,
and that is Israel, where it's easy to start crying for the poor Palestinians in Israel, but the same hypocrites who are so quick to cry and blame Israel, first of all, don't look at the role of the Arab countries in the plight of the Palestinians. They do not look into what the Palestinians are doing to themselves, killing more each other per year than anyone gets killed by the Jews. And the status of the Palestinians in Arab countries, where they are, like in the edicts of the Tsar that I'm telling you happened 1,200 years ago, they are edicts against the Palestinians that are not permitted to own homes and hold professions, and the children are not allowed to go to the schools, and they are isolated in camps in Lebanon and in Syria and in Jordan, and their lives are even more miserable because they don't get the funding that they get from European Union and from the United Nations. And they don't have the mansions and the villas that their elite steal and buy and build for themselves. But that is the litmus test. If somebody really cares about the Palestinians, they would care about their plight everywhere. But they only care about when it's related to Israel, which tells us that this is anti-Semitism.
I know this is.
But we are digressing from the story. But that's part of how anti-Semitism develops. You look for a scapegoat. You look for a reason for something that you dislike, and you turn it into something that you demonize, and you project to all Jews, and then justify various mistreatment of the Jews based upon the myth that you create.
I know, that is the sad part. So we're dealing with sex trafficking, and this man, they just took him at face value.
Tzvi Migdal is the name of the union, legal union, Tzvi Migdal, Tzvi Migdal, that operated with impunity for 70 years, and it was legal in South America, headquartered in Buenos Aires, but it spread all through South America, into Europe, into Beijing, into the New York Lower East Side. And it was legal. So that meant that the women that they captured, they now enslaved and owned them. It's mind-boggling to us. At least today, that will not be legal to own them.
It's scary. Now, she's a strong girl, this girl. So she gets there. How does she deal with the other girls that are there? And she had a chaperone, and the chaperone was even worse than these other people were. The chaperone gets away with what he does also. So how did she bond with the girls, and why is the chaperone that was supposed to be with her someone that she was supposed to trust, that we knew right away that you couldn't trust him? That was an important point in the story, too.
Correct. There are different aspects to the story, and unless your listeners have read the book, we don't want to give them too much information.
Tell them.
But the betrayals go in different ways. You learn not to trust people on one hand, and as Batya says at one point, where someone seems to want to help her, that any prostitute who trusts promises is a fool. But at the same time, the women developed friendships. There were also a lot of crazy girls because they were all had been through so many traumas. You're talking about various characters and various people who live, who are in the brothels. But in terms of creating a new family, and that's what people do when they isolated, and that's what the girls did in the brothel.
So what happens, I was so sad, the sisters got me, when they get sick, what happens to them? Who takes care of them if they get ill? And who was in charge of making sure that they were prepared for the men? I mean, it didn't matter, whatever. They just had to do what they were supposed to do, or they were going to have a problem or get punished, which is horrible. So what happens when one of the girls gets very, very sick? So how do they deal with that? I mean, you can't just let the girl just die, or maybe they just didn't care.
Of course they will let her die because they wouldn't want to spend money on health care.
They didn't care.
First of all, health care in the late 1800s was really minimal. There were hospitals in Buenos Aires, and prostitutes and others it was available to them. But the healthcare level was really minimal. It was in a country that was developing fast and definitely was not paying attention to people. But in terms of the owners of the brothels, it was always a matter of cost, how much you want to spend on a girl who's sick, and how much would it be worth to get her better? And it's usually the answer is that it was not, did not pay. And you know, they did get sick. They got venereal diseases galore because that's what was happening. The women were totally a commodity. They were faceless people in that respect.
What would happen if one of the girls got pregnant by accident? What would they do then? You would hope that they didn't, but you never know.
They had forced abortions, but they also, many of their women had children.
Mm-hmm.
They did have children. It was hard to avoid pregnancies because birth control was not totally available the way it is today. And the women did get pregnant. Very often they sent their children to some families out of town. As we know from only one case, there's only one case of all of the tens of thousands of women victims. One case of Raquel Lieberman, who knew how to write and wrote letters to her sons, and also she became relatively known. Her letters have been published. So she raised them with a village. It's with some family, and visited them occasionally. And that's how they grew up.
That's so sad. It is so sad that they didn't even get to really know who their parents are. They probably didn't even know it. So tell us about her family, about her family and about her sister. I mean, that's basically, she wanted to bring her sister here too, eventually. Then it's like heartbreaking. Every time I read another chapter, I had to get another box of tissues. Seriously.
Yeah, it's not an easy book, but
no.
I did have to tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
It was no point in sugarcoating the suffering of the women. And that said, I still sugarcoated it in some instances. In this book, Batya had originally promised her parents to bring to help them come to the new world. And they believe that she has made a fabulous marriage, a fabulous matchmaking, shidduch, which, as we know, turned out to be not the case. They are waiting for her to bring them to the new world. And again, I do not want to tell the story.
No.
And she is not bringing them because she does not want them to know what happened to them. It would kill them. The sorrow, there's nothing they could do from overseas, from where they are, simple family. So she doesn't tell them, and she has to live with that uncertainty and guilt. And that's the anger and frustration over the fact that she's not bringing them, and why is she negating her story? But again, I don't want to go into the story. I hope that the listeners are going to read it very soon. And by the way, the novel just won the Jewish Book Council Award in the book club category, losing first place to Alice Hoffman, getting second place as a finalist, which is now obviously become a fabulously recommended book for book groups, and also the Organization for Conservative Judaism, which is the umbrella organization of all the sisterhoods in the United States, made the book their year, this one read for the year. They have many other recommendations of books, but this is the one in which there are discussions. I'm going to be streaming with them an interview that's quite unique. So all of that, the book is doing very, very well among readers and book groups.
Do you do book clubs too? I'm asking for a reason.
I do book clubs with only Skype because now...
That's what I'm saying, that's what I mean.
Yes, I Skype if my calendar permits me. I'm very busy. I have about probably 30 or 40 personal appearances coming up.
I see.
I've already started, obviously. But so if my schedule allows, I love it. I love talking to book groups and chatting with them. We do that on Skype. And I have a few a week. This week alone, last week, I had a few that I was able to fit in.
No, my two cousins, one's in Florida.
By the way, I want to say to write to me. If they want to, they should contact me through my website, where I'm the contact, www.taliacarner.com. My name is
P-A-L-I-A-C-A-R-N-E-R. My cousins are both in book clubs. They called me last week about this other thing, and they were asking me what to read and what they think, my opinion. So I know that the one in Florida, I'm going to email her and tell her, the other one in Virginia, they would read this. They definitely would. I think their book club would love it also. It'd be fantastic.
Yeah, I'm in Florida for the winter, so your cousin.
Oh, good. That's even better.
Can check my website for personal appearances. I just did last week. I did three personal appearances in Palm Beach. I have one coming up this week in White Cliff. It's all South Florida. I was the week before. I was on the west coast of Florida. So yeah, that's still easy. And then I want to tell everybody on March 20th. At lunchtime, I will appear at the UN Commission on the Status of Women, and this event is set off outside the UN building, so that we do not need to have UN credentials to get in. You need an ID and you need to pre-register, which you do that. You find the information on my website. But there are others coming up in New York in that last week in March. New York, New Jersey, I'm running around with like 7 events. Long Island, in one day I'm running from one to another. So it's all fun and interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is interesting, isn't it? I'm just trying to finish my last book. My mom's book is being republished because the publisher
That's
went
wonderful.
Out. My a daughter's parents, my mom had Alzheimer's, so it's her story and my story talking about it. And then I have to come up with a title for my new book, which is a horror. I write from the point of view of the person that's dead that's telling the story behind the gravestone. And there's like 4 stories that are sort of like Twilight Zone. They're scary, but I haven't come up with a title yet, and I have to write one more. But, yeah, it's exciting, but you seem to be having really a lot of fun. So throughout the novel, we have Batya's voice. Not too many people could be strong and withstand all of her, what she went through. How would you describe her courage? And then I'm going to go to the talking points that you sent me. I have them in front of me.
How do I describe her courage?
In she had her courage. Case, I mean, she didn't give up. She didn't give up.
In her case, it was the motivation to save her family. Had she not had that background and the love of her family going both ways, she probably would have broken down, as she was almost broken down at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the faith. She believed that God was there watching her. And it was mm-hmm. something that I discovered was fascinating, how all of these women who had been enslaved believed in, were Jewish, and it was their Jewish identity. They spoke Yiddish. They couldn't pick up another identity.
Mm-hmm.
Even though many of them were illiterate, because in the shtetl, girls did not go to school, where if they learned to read and write Yiddish, they couldn't even read the Bible or the siddur for the prayers. And so it was a very interesting phenomenon how they retained their faith throughout. And she did, and that gave her strength. And once her mother died, she found out her mother had died, she connected with her mother because now she believed that her mother saw what was going on in her life, and she could now communicate and draw strength from her mother. And rather than suffer her mother's wrath for having betrayed them or not living up to her, the promise, her she could now see, her mother could see what was going on and gave her strength.
Well, let's go to the talking points. This is amazing that the Argentine government made money. Prostitution flourished in 1800 to 1900, and nobody did anything about it. And then the cultural growth of Buenos Aires is often referred to as where the coercion is present. Why did they think that this was the only way for them to get money? And the government was in on it, so it doesn't matter whether anybody knew. They were going to let it get away anyway. They didn't care.
Prostitution was legal in both Brazil and Argentina, where Trinidad was the biggest. Those were Catholic countries, and they believed that prostitution was, a quote, protected good women and families.
Oh,
end
wow.
quote. So much so that the Jesuits in Brazil wrote to the Queen of Portugal and asked her to send more prostitutes. The Argentine government generated 25% of its budget in the early 1900s from brothels. And that is a fact. they mentioned that prostitution was not just legal, but ownership of these women was legal. So once they kidnapped them under false pretense from their country of origins and brought them, they owned them, they registered them with the town, and now they were their property, the way not long before in the United States, white owned black slaves. If a slave ran off and went to the police to complain, the police would bring him or her back to their rightful owner. And this is how it was, even if those slavery was not legal in Argentina. They did not have black slaves. But prostitution, they didn't see that as a slavery in the same way as for us. It's just very clear that that's what it was.
I just wonder sometimes.
I must say that at least today we have laws on the books.
I hope so.
That would help people who run away. The problem is that if they are foreign-born, they do not speak the language, their passports are being taken away, they are being threatened with the threat to their families back home, but also they don't know the U.S. police and U.S. laws. They believe that the police is probably as corrupt and cruel as the police in their home countries. So for them, it doesn't even occur to them to try to find help from the police. And that's part of the tragedy.
It is so amazing. And I wonder, seriously, if these government officials, if it was their child or their daughter or their person, somebody related to them, would they have done something about it, or is it just a profit of money? Because that bothers me, because they're right there. They have kids, too. I mean, it could happen to just about anybody.
Yeah, it's very often they don't make this projection from one to the other. The pimps had families. They had children. They were family men, and I say men, they were also women, but mostly men, and they had families, and that did not make them any more sympathetic. Actually, in the book, we get to know that the trafficker, whom we get to know the most, Moskowitz, believed that he'd done these women a favor. They were starving.
Oh, God.
They were living in terrible conditions before. And now they were having good life, they had clothes, they were eating, they were going to parties, and some of the women even agreed with that if they had the kind of brothel where things were relatively comfortable, that they found them to be more of an improvement over the life of the shtetl, misery and squalor and poverty. And the pogroms that threaten them all the time.
It's so sad. So I mean, I read the news, listened to the news this morning, and that father, Sarah Lawrence College, and he did the same thing to them, and he's finally going up to a bail hearing. I would give him a lock, put him away in no hearing. So sex trafficking today, both the same and different from the time of the novel, and people that are, they're people that know, see, like there's a house, I mean, sometimes there's a house, and you see a lot of people going in, but you don't see anybody coming out, and you're not sure. What can people do when they know that something is happening? How can they get around it if it's happening in their own backyard? What do you do? Because you can't keep a blind eye, or maybe you can.
If you're talking about a brothel, it's very hard for people to maintain a brothel in a good neighborhood because there's just too much traffic. The neighbors notice and they notify the police. And so they use hotels, and for that now, hotels have different programs. Marriott is very good at educating their staff, and they have relationship with the local precincts, and then sends a plain clothes officer, they don't want to create a big scene in the lobby, but right then and there, they deal with the situation. But what I would like to tell the listeners is what they can do is to help the people being trafficked, and there are many, many ways. From children who are vulnerable today, the recruitment age for New York born, United States born, are 12 to 14, which means they're in school, which means there are ways to protect them. They may have families in crisis. There are ways to try to help them, right in a school and right in different a social program. And then there are programs for those who people, women, and I must say women, there are some boys, there are some trans, but by far, by greatest women, and there are more black women. And by the way, tend to be, meaning all men, but not all men buy sex. So those who buy sex buy it in large quantities frequently with a lot, as we see with some cases where we find. And what happens is, to help the victims, they've already had, usually, they've had so much sex abuse and rape in their childhood that by the time they're recruited, it's not the worst thing to happen. So they have low self-esteem, out of prostitution and get some marketing skills. They need, if they have a prison record, no employer wants to hire them, that needs to be purged, and there are organizations that help with that. They need vocational training, they need rehabilitation from drugs, they need psychological help, they need to be held by hand, and there are many organizations that do that. And I encourage your listeners to go on my website, www.taliacarner.com, and to the page that says Activism, what can you do to help? And it gives you links to many organizations, right? In your own neighborhood, you can find them and see where you can help, where local organizations can help, and individuals can get involved.
That is true. I'm putting it on my Facebook wall.
Thank you.
I'm doing that now because I very rarely do that in the middle. But I'm getting good at this. I get it with one hand. Okay, we have about 15 minutes, but this is such an important topic that when I listen to the news this morning and I see that there's a father out there that was doing this for years, or there are houses, it just angers you to think that you never know. The economic model.
I'll give you an example of how something like this happens. Okay.
Yeah, that would help.
But I don't know about this father, but I'll give you an example. A girl has a fight with a mother. Her best friend, and this is a real case. Her best friend says, "Come stay with me for a few days." The best friend's mother is so happy. Okay, come stay with us. She buys the girls matching pajamas. They have a pajamas party.
Mm-hmm.
She takes photographs of the girls, each and individually. Then after a few days, she posts the guest girls' photos on a particular website and actually sells her.
Oh, God.
The next day, the girl comes back from school. There's a knock. She's back from school in the afternoon. I'm talking about the guest. There's a knock on the door. A man comes, and the brother of her friend says, "Somebody's here to see you." She says, "I don't know anybody." No, he's here to see you. And then when it becomes clear, he says to her, "You've lived here now for 6 days. You owe us rent. You'll pay the rent by giving him a oral sex, and then you'll be fine." So she's forced into this. He takes video of that, and now he says to her, the son and the mother, say to her, if you don't do it tomorrow, we are going to post this video on the school, the entire school will have it. So the next day, she gets 3 men show up at the door, and the girl goes to the school counselor and tells her. The school counselor doesn't believe her. Says her, this girl is so troubled, no way this is happening. The next day, takes a few more days of this, the girl goes to the counselor again and says, please, this is happening, and check this website. I saw on this website that they're selling me. I saw the photographs in my pajamas. Like pajamas. So the counselor says, I can't access from the school computer this kind of a website. She says, he's on my phone. And on the phone, she sees it, and the number to call is the number of the mother of her friend where she's staying. Mm. So only then does the school counselor believe her. Okay? And by that time, the school counselor could have helped her in day one. So it takes education on so many levels. And this is how it happened.
This is so sad. It is so sad. And then by that time, she's could have need psychological help or even worse. So before we end, the economic model of supply procures demand in sex trafficking industry and the new paradigm of cracking down on people that are buying sex. It doesn't matter what race they are, as long as they serve whatever they want. But the buyers are more white and educated males. These men are married, aren't they? Don't they have wives and children too, these same males?
I don't really have a profile. I mean, I don't know that there is enough of a research with the profiling of the men, other than we know that they tend to be more white, affluent, rather than low income, but not exclusively. We see in major sports events where there is increase in demand, and it comes from all kinds of men of all walks of life. But I would like to explain the supply and demand paradigm. The supply is going to be inexhaustible as long as there's life and war and misery and poverty around the globe.
Mm-hmm.
The suppliers respond as long as their profit and the risks are minimal. It's the demand side that drives the business.
Mm.
Trafficking. And the demand side buys sex. Attacks the problem. We bring the prostitutes, but lock up the giants, publish their names, and make sure that they are dealt with properly as perpetrators that they are. And needless to say, very often those girls are also underage, so we are talking pedophilia. We're talking breaking the law on so many levels. So they need to be dealt with directly. And until we as a society begin to see the problem, not as a supply problem, meaning I'm in South Florida now, and people tell me, oh, there are so many immigrants here, that's why we are big market. No, the big market here or in Dallas, which is the number one, is because more men are willing to pay for sex. So we need to go directly to the source. Also, educating men is important, because once they begin to understand that regardless of how these women behave, solicit, dress, they are victims. When they begin to understand that, we begin to then deal with the problem, because they begin to see the humanity of the victims, and rather than exploit them, they learn that these women operate under threats, the threats to their families back home, the threats mm-hmm. to themselves, and that, again, regardless of how they behave, there's a third party who now gets the money and enjoys the fruit of this women's enslavement. And that's where the paradigm of supply and demand.
Is there anybody in the book that helped them? Is there anybody that was on her side? We have about five more minutes. Is there anybody that was on her side? We don't want to talk about the book. I know, I got it.
About the story of the book because that's part of the plot of how she gets out of it. And it's not for the potential readers to do that. But
no matter how much help they get, no matter whether they get out of it or not, they're going to still need help, right, at the end. If they ever get free, they're going to still need some counseling or something.
A lot, and that's why I suggest that your listeners will get, go on my website under the activism, mm-hmm. what can you do to help, and there's a lot mm-hmm. that they can do to help. And
What about schools? What about going to schools and colleges? What about actually a class in why this is so important? I mean, how many young girls that are like 19 and 18, 19 that live in group homes or that don't have family to guide them, and then they get into this because they figure prostitution is a way to get money, and they don't care. So I think they need a little re-education, a little education here. As an educator, I mean, to me that would make sense. That guidance counselors and college people, college deans or whatever, would come in and have, you know, people come in to talk to classes about that.
Yeah, and the education actually has to start from fourth grade for 10 years old. Because they are the ones who are victims, and now more and more there are programs. There's an organization called ProtectNow.org that is in California-based. And Governor Brown signed their program into law 10 years ago already, and they teach from fourth grade on. They have age-appropriate programs, but they also had to educate the board, the teacher, to create a protocol.
Yeah.
The teacher did suspect there's a case. What kind of questions she asks, does she refer the child to, they deal with. They teach the child in a judgmental way, but give compassion. For example, a 14-year-old who is popular and begins to dress nice, has an expensive iPhone, and she tells about her 20-some-odd boyfriend who takes her to clubs and bars. And with her friends. So how do the other children who now hear it, what do they do? Protocol, they teach them. They through play acting, through compassion, to understand what may be happening. And that's very important because the kids at this age may be really difficult, and especially on somebody who's vulnerable. But it is those people who are vulnerable that are most likely to be picked up. So those kind of programs are now little by little coming into schools, definitely not fast enough. In Florida, they are now beginning. And in some other parts, the age, it varies in age. And I want to mention something. It falls under the health issue. The kids that have the hotline number, goes to a health center. This is not a law enforcement issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it gets enforcement, but it's a health issue because of all the psychological, physical health that they need in getting them out of safety and before it happens. That's important.
That is so true. Also, you know, as an educator, I taught older kids. all the students. And if the girls came in inappropriately dressed, I would exactly talk to them nicely and explain that, you know, this is why you're getting looked at by the boys. And actually, they agreed with me. And the parents agreed with me because you have to look appropriate. But before we go, what's next for you? Are you going to continue this story? You're going to see what happens to her, or are you going to start with something brand new?
Each one of my novels is a standalone story. I think I exhaust the issue in terms of this particular story, and I'm off to the next one. As you know, this is my fifth novel.
Mm-hmm.
All my novels have had social issues behind them, some more heart-wrenching than others, but they're all pretty strong. And I encourage your listeners to go and read this one, or if they have, then pick any of my previous novels, and they can read the first chapter of each on my website and see what absolutely catches them. I am researching my next novel, but because it takes me so many years to write a novel, there's not much that can be said about it, other than it is set in France. But beyond that, it takes me years to write a book. You know, some authors write very fast. I don't try to do that. I try to do whatever at the level that's convenient for me.
Well, that's what you have to, because otherwise it doesn't come out right. So where can everybody learn more about you and your work? And I just sent my cousin an email about your book.
My website has various information, my bio, the books, the reviews, the interviews, and, of course, the action. It also has a translation, my translation of a short story by Sholem Aleichem called The Man from Buenos Aires, which is the story that inspired me to follow that particular thread and see what happened and connect the Fiddler on the Roof original story with that. All of that is on www.taliacarner.com. That's TaliaCarner.com.
Thank you so very much for today. This is very enlightening. And I can't wait to get your next one. When you get it, you just got to let me know. And everybody, it's a beautiful, I don't know how it is where you are. Well, you're not that far away. You're on the island. And I'm in Upper Westchester.
No, but I'm in Florida.
Oh, you're
I'm
right.
In Florida now for the winter.
I just emailed my cousin in Florida just now to tell her about your book. I'm sure she's going to call me later and want to know more. But your area code is the same. So thank you so much,
correct,
everybody. Have a great day. It's beautiful outside. It's only, let's see how much it is today. It's 49 degrees. There's a heat wave out here. Have a great day, and bye.
Thank you very much.